The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Good afternoon. This is Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. You're on News Dissector Radio here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. There's a number to call if you'd like to join us a little later in the show. 877. That's a free number. 877-888. Okay, do me a favor. Yeah, I'll do it. Yeah, excuse me. I'm in a studio. Okay, I've been coming here for weeks, months, a year, and in front of me are two numbers, okay, completely unexplained to the host. So I'm reading one, which is the wrong number, the old number, and the wonder, I'm being interrupted and I'm being told, no, that's not the number. If that's not the number, why is it in front of me? Never mind, doesn't matter. Here's the number to call if you'd like to join me, 888-874-4888, and that's, I'm going to say it again, 888-874-4888, you can join me. Here in the studio with me is a friend from Spain who's just dropped in. She had no idea she was going to be on a radio show, but she's going to roll with the punches. We're going to hear more. And also Green Arrow, DJ Green Arrow, who's been working with me, is here as well. And we're going to be talking about several different issues about, you know, what we're working on and all the rest of it. But we're going to start the program today. We're going to go back to the Middle East because that's where it's happening. That's the drama right now in the world. Part of the drama in the world is what's happening in Libya, but not just Libya, Bahrain, Yemen, Syria, who knows where else. There's uprisings, there's a complete struggle for freedom, for human rights, and the rest of it, and it's getting kind of a weird kind of coverage here in America. We'll be talking about that as well. And soon to join me on the phone is the editor of the Independent newspaper. That's INDYPENDT, a great paper which has actually been doing original coverage of what's happening in the Middle East. Arun, I guess is how you would say it properly, is going to be on the line with me in a minute to tell me a little bit about what he's been writing and also what his colleagues are thinking about what's happening in the Middle East. There are people who are trying to make change in America, identifying with the people in the Middle East who are trying to make change there, and guess what? They've been writing about it in a very informed and interesting way. So, we'll be moving into all of that, but first a little song in Arabic. The lyrics of my friend Nainat Bhak's song on freedom, a salute to the people fighting for freedom in the Middle East and around the world. Let's listen to it. Everybody, the Nainat Bhak band doing a song really to try to support the people who are struggling around the world. He's done it. It has lyrics in many different languages. He himself lives on basically Croatia on Hudson. He's from Croatia, but it's Croton on Hudson in New York, upstate. In the tip of Westchester, and you know, I've gone to see him perform it live, so I wanted to share it with you. Now, joining me on the radio is the editor of the Independent, or an editor of the Independent, a very cool journalist who's been working on these issues. Hi there, Arun, is that how you say it?
Arun, hi Danny, how are you doing today?
Good. Okay, don't want to overhype you, but I was downtown the other night at the Blue. What's the name of the bookstore? The Blue Stockings bookstore.
Blue Stockings.
And listening to a talk about sex. Yeah, hello, I'm here. and listening to a talk about sex. outside, I picked up a copy of the paper, and I was really impressed with the coverage that you're offering about the Middle East, opinion pieces, but very analytical, very balanced. Tell us a little bit about The Independent and about how you're approaching covering this crisis.
Well, the Independent is part of the Global Indie Media Network. We started back in 2000, and there were, at one point, I think maybe about 200 indie media centers around the world, especially in the Western world, West Europe, throughout Latin America, some in Asia and Africa. And the idea was people on the ground coming together to produce media. And it was a link to the anti-globalization movement.
That's, yeah, it grew out of the battle in Seattle, didn't it? I mean, against
exactly.
the World Trade Organization protests.
The very first media center was in Seattle, which is a whole interesting story in and of itself. It was essentially a technological innovation. A bunch of anarchist techies came up with this, what was called the rich text media. It was proto-blogging. What it was is the website allowed anyone to post content, and it could be print, video, audio, photography. And it was initially meant to serve to be of use by alternative journalists who had come to the cover the WTO ministerial in Seattle. But people who were there at the protests knew about it and quickly started posting their own content, and it was remarkable. I had no idea what it was, but I stumbled on it when I was looking for good news coverage of what was going on that day, and I had been just finding a lot of terrible corporate coverage, whether on cable or on the internet, and it was just really an epiphany. You just had a tremendous amount of content straight from the street, all these reports, all this information. At one point during the Seattle protests, the indie media site was actually getting more hits than CNN, millions of hits a day. And so it just experienced explosive growth after that. The New York City Center was set up a few months later in 2000, and I joined in the fall of 2000.
Well, this is very interesting because, you know, we've heard a lot of discussion about social media, which only gets defined as Facebook, or it gets defined, you know, as Twitter, you know, commercial basic services. It doesn't get defined as citizen journalism, as people who are actually reporting. We have, you know, with us in the studio as part of this whole conversation, a member of the Journalist Union in España, in Spain. Would you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what's happening in Spain on the media front journalistically?
Sure. My name is...
Hello, is the mic up for this woman? Hello? Okay, go ahead, speak.
Okay. So my name is Patricia Estevez, and I am part of the Catalonian Journalist Union and the Spanish Federation of Journalist Unions, and I'm an independent writer as well as researcher. The media in Spain is basically concentrating hugely, and it is being bought by Berlusconi as well. So Berlusconi will not only have a media empire in Italy, but also in Spain, of all things. And I would actually want to add to that you were saying that there's a lot of, you know, just the people reporting on independent media. I would say that there is a lot of journalists who don't conform with what's going on corporate media that are joining the independent media just basically because they don't find their voice anywhere else. And this is happening in Spain and all throughout Europe.
And in this room, actually. You know, as your news dissector, I worked at ABC News. I worked at CNBC. I worked at, you know, at CNN. You know, and now I'm an independent journalist, a hero in the eyes of, in the words of the New York Daily News, a hero of downward mobility, working as a writer and blogger and jogger, if you will. Gary Knoll is the jogger at this station, but I'm, you know, writing a blog every day on newsdissector.com/blog, and I'm writing for many different websites, including Al Jazeera's, about things. So I'm offering an independent media perspective. I haven't been asked yet to write for The Independent, but that might come someday. Talk to me a little bit about how this newspaper came out of this whole internet, largely internet-driven movement.
Well, when I came along, a number of activists had just published the first edition of a newspaper. They had received a small grant, and I was very much interested in print, doing a print project, because I had actually got my start as a professional journalist in the early 1990s, working for a newspaper a few folks might remember, The Guardian Newsweekly. That's not the British Guardian. It was a storied radical newsweekly in the United States that published from 1948 to 1992.
I knew it well and read it well, often.
Yeah, it was.
Liberated Guardian, which opposed the regular Guardian. I mean, it was a typical left-wing, you know, 10 people, 20 opinions, but it was a consistently excellent progressive newsweekly. So you worked for them.
Yeah, for its last 3 years, and that fell apart in 1992, various pressures, especially it's always economic in the end. The recession really is what did it in the end. But when I came to the New York City Indie Media Center, I was immediately like, I want to work on a print project. And there were a number of other people there who also wanted to work on a print project. The early years were pretty interesting. When I was at The Guardian, I worked on the international news desk. And at first, there was a definite sentiment against covering international news in The Independent. If folks remember, that was 2001 was kind of the height of the second Palestinian Intifada against the Israeli occupation. And I kept pushing, you know, that we need to cover this stuff, we need to cover this stuff. And it finally took me about a year before I convinced the other members of the editorial collective to let me write a piece about the Palestinians, analyzing what was happening with the Palestinian Intifada. And that came out about, that issue came out about 1 week before September 11th. And after September 11th, there wasn't any more question about covering international issues. People were like, okay, you know, obviously we have to cover international issues. And so what The Independent is trying to do is just to be a general interest newspaper. We've stumbled upon an interesting model. We're not subscription-based. We're a free publication. We distribute to about 500 places in the New York metropolitan region. We publish about 20,000 copies an issue. So we're actually one of the largest left newspapers in the United States. We come out about 17 times a year, every 3 weeks. We really want to be bi-weekly or even weekly, but it takes a lot of funding to do that.
Let me jump in here for a second, because you have a very good website, and a lot of the content is on the web as well. Give us that URL, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, there are a couple of websites. There's the website of the newspaper, which is independent.org, which is, it's just like independent, but with a Y, I-N-D-Y. P-E-N-D-E-N-T. And then there's also the New York City Indie Media site. Now, on the newspaper site, folks can also subscribe. We do have a few hundred subscribers, and they play a very important role in helping to financially sustain the paper. Most of them also contribute above the subscription. And this really allows us to engage the broader public. And like I said, I think what's interesting about our model is we're definitely a left paper, but what we really try to do is very thoughtful, analytical, historically based journalism. There's such a flood of content on the web now that I think the role of print publications, really what they have to do is help people conceptualize the world, to help give them categories and ideas, but to embed that in the reporting. And so that's what we really try to do. Our journalism is
contextualizing things in more depth, right?
Yeah. A lot of it tends to be long-form journalism, like articles of about 2,000 or 3,000 words. We have a lot of scholars writing for us because, I think people who spent their life studying a subject are often able to provide a lot of the most interesting insight historically, socially, culturally. And what we've especially of late been trying to do is to break down certain barriers, like I think on the left there's a tendency to really see things just in terms of material conditions, and the left often forgets how to engage people. It forgets the role of mass psychology. It forgets that culture is more than about hey, does this movie or book support the revolution or not? You really have to engage people's desires and bigger issues, bigger questions, such as freedom. Or liberation, or what end is it going all towards? A lot of the coverage, say, coming out of the union battles in the United States, a lot of the attacks on public sector workers, it's very economistic, and of course we want to improve people's lives, right? They should have access to housing, they should have access to health care.
Well, I think I think that's one of the strengths of the paper. Is that it really engages all sides of people's lives and their interests, not just the narrowly focusing it on one topic or one subject. And I think that that's part of what we really need to bring up back to, because part of what the internet does is it, gives us so many choices. So we tend to look for stories that are familiar to us, or writers that we already know, or websites we've already visited. And the consequence of that, is that we don't get surprised. We don't discover new content. We don't learn about new artists or new ideas. And that's why I think the idea of something that's edited in a way to really engage people and their sensibilities is very important. And I'm, a big fan of that. I just wanted to mention one thing to you. It's kind of funny, maybe, because you were talking about the Palestinians and the Palestinian Intifada. The other day, I was on the West Bank, the West Side of Manhattan, up at Columbia University. It was Land Day in Palestine 34 years ago. People who were protesting against the dispossession of their land by the Israeli occupation, a number of them were killed. And this day became a day to commemorate their sacrifice, martyrdom, whatever, and to call attention to the issue of land, which is, of course, the central issue really discussed in that part of the world. Whose land is it? And you can't take mine away like this just because you have some guns. So there was a protest at Columbia University, as there was around the world, by Palestinians. And there was basically a group, students for Free Palestine, I believe, who were organizing in front of the Lowe Library right on the campus at Columbia. And they had built a tank out of cardboard. Okay, and they were doing dances, Palestinian dances, to show the spirit of the people, and then they were doing a die-in on the floor to show what was happening to them. It was kind of dramatic. They were very energetic, very passionate, and very interesting. And I was invited by a producer to come and document this as a TV producer and filmmaker. I thought that would be interesting, so I went up there to do it. And lo and behold, I get told... we start shooting, and I get told that we can't continue because we don't have a permit. No permit. It sounded like China. You can't cover a protest at Columbia University. And the reason given, you love this one, it's private property. Columbia University, I don't even have a figure of the amount, billions of dollars that have been of public money that's been given to Columbia University over the years. But now it's, quote, private, and you can't cover it without a permit.
Mm-hmm.
So I say to the cop, okay, what should I do? He says, well, go down to the media relations office. It's in that building, of course, on the other end of the campus, and request get a permit. I said, okay, that's a hassle, but I'll do it, you know. So I go down to the other building, which houses, by the way, the Rune Arledge Auditorium. Rune Arledge was the god of TV news at ABC News when I worked there, and he went to Columbia. He donated this auditorium. Anyway, so I went in there, you know, Rune's place. There's a student there. I said, I'm here to get a permit. You know, the campus police sent me here. The girl says, the student, you know, says, no media office here. There's no media relations office here. It's in the building that you just came from. I said, they sent me here. She says, no, go back there, because they always do that. They send people here. They don't know where anything is. This is there. She's commenting on the campus police at Columbia. I said, oh, no. So I go back. I walk past the journalism school, where I actually was an adjunct professor and actually taught in journalism, and went back to the Low Library, and the media relations office is up on the fourth floor, and working with Green Arrow. DJ Green Arrow was with me. We both went up to the office to request a permit very innocently and in good faith with what we were told to do. And we get there, and we walk into the office, and it's like a wall of hostility. Arun, can you stay with us through the show? I don't want to cut off your time, but as it turns out, there's no guest in the second half hour, and I'd love you to stay with us. I'm telling the story because it's so fascinating. I wrote about it in my blog today. So I go to this office. I said, we want to get a permit for, I'm here with a crew. We're just covering, we were asked to come cover this protest by these Palestinians, and, you know, it's really straightforward. It's happening right out front here. What's the big deal? They said, oh, no, you have to send a letter in advance to request a permit. I said, like, to who? They gave me the name of the guy, okay? And the guy's name, I happen to have his card here, is none other than Robert Hornsby, Director, Media Relations, Office of Communications and Public Affairs, Columbia University, in the city of New York, 402 Low Library, okay? At Columbia, his phone number, 212-854-9752. So, Robert, the chief of the office, you know, you have to write to him. Okay, that's the procedure. I think it's a bit far-fetched, but I'll do it. So I take out my little iPhone. I start tapping out a little email to Robert. I keep making mistakes. I go back. You know, I'm here in your office. I'm here to request, can I meet with you? The people say, no, he's much too busy to meet with you. You can't meet with him. Send him the email. So I send, finally, I'm in the process of ending the email. All of a sudden, his office door bursts open, and in walks Robert, okay? Hornsby, Director, Media Relations at Columbia University, and he asks me this question. Why are you camping out in my office? What are you doing here? Said, you know, are you occupying? Suddenly I'm occupying his office, right? You know, I said, no, I'm not. You know, I'm just making a request. But guess what? He doesn't respond to my request, and they say, you have to leave now. So I get thrown out of the office. I go downstairs, and on the staircase, I run into no fewer than five plainclothes Columbia University campus cops who have obviously been summoned, okay? Who is this guy? What's he doing in our building? Why was he in my office? You know, it's like I'm from Hamas. You know, I said, no, I'm not from Hamas. I'm from Chelsea, you know, down in Manhattan, you know, basically to cover this thing. And the cops say, you know, well, maybe he's a little, but we do have rules and regulations. It's private property. You have to have you can do the interviews, but you have to go off the campus in the street and do the interview. So, of course, we ended up doing it, looking back onto the campus where we couldn't do the interview, which looks much worse for Columbia University. But this is just a little experience with free speech and covering protest in New York at an enlightened liberal university. Hello. What's this about? Do you guys ever have this type of an experience?
Well, I mean, you know, it's whenever we do try to go out and cover stuff, I mean, our reporters tend to operate pretty independently, which I guess is appropriate. I've had, certain experiences like the NYPD refusing to give me a press pass for years. I haven't actually tried in a while. There was a recent case where they were refusing to give people who weren't affiliated with, like, large news outfits press passes, and I think a couple years ago, finally, after a lot of wrangling and some civil liberties lawyers got involved, they were able, some bloggers were able to get press passes. And I had a funny incident, not funny, but interesting incident in 2004 trying to get a press pass to the RNC, where they just flat out refused.
That's the Republican National Convention that was held here in New York.
They also refused to give it to Amy Goodman at Democracy Now.
Right. Okay. Well, you were in good company. I actually did get in, believe it or not, to the Republican National Convention, and I looked up, and I guess who was right in front of me, right over me? Dick Cheney. Can you believe it? I mean, I had to leave the area. I was afraid of, you know, contamination. Patricia, do you guys have problems like this, getting accreditation?
Definitely. We have lots of problems because there's not a single press pass in Spain. Like, you can't go to the police and they'll give you some kind of identification that you're a journalist. The way you get it is through your media. And the thing is, only corporate media is considered as being journalists. So we, as the journalist union, we are the only ones, the only union giving actually press acknowledgement to independent media in Spain. And I can tell you that that doesn't happen, like, not even anywhere else in Europe, basically.
So you know, sometimes you need to have an organization give you some kind of information. DJ Green Arrow, who is here, is carrying a card. Tell us about your accreditation. This will really interest you, okay?
Well, I'm a sovereign individual. My face is my ID. And when I lost my driver's license, I decided that I would get a Zulu Nation membership card. Universal Zulu Nation is an internationally protected organization like the Cherokee tribe or the Apache tribe. So I used it when I got my passport.
And they gave you a passport?
Yeah. It's acceptable as a state ID.
Afrika Bambaataa is your leader?
Yes, Afrika Bambaataa. Well, he's not my leader. He's a great man, and he's a role model and mentor for me. He created hip hop, but he also created an organization that allows him to travel without a passport. You know,
and so read what it says. What does it say?
Well, it has a hologram that says secure three times, and it has my ID number, which is 70262. It has my address on it. It says Universal Zulu Nation World International Movement. It's got an ankh on it. Got a picture of the world, and on the back it has the living being listed on this card as a registered member of the Universal Zulu Nation. As a member of an internationally protected organization, the member on this card is guaranteed all the proper international protections. And then it reads USC 18 section 12, internationally protected person, so it's a definition. It has the criminal codes about conspiracy and color of authority. So if someone acts up on me with the intent to kill me, they get life imprisonment or death.
You just have to flash that card. Patricia, maybe they can open a chapter in Spain.
And, well, they have a chapter in Spain.
Okay, well, maybe we can get her an ID also. And also for the independent newspaper. Arun, we're going to take a break in a minute. And when we come back, I want to really talk a little bit about your coverage of the Middle East. That's what we started to talk about. We've kind of deviated a little bit, but it's been interesting. I hope, a conversation. Again, the number 888-874-4888. Sherry Welch can't be with us today. She's speaking like this. She's got some sort of affliction down there in Atlanta. So we have to proceed without her. But you're welcome to join us on this program. By the way, we will have a podcast of this program available probably later today. So the Independent, you can put it up on your website if you want, our interview, or in Spain or wherever. This is a whole idea of trying to foster communication between people from around the world, different perspectives and different critical ideas about media and journalism. That's partly what we're about. So we'll be back in a few minutes, but first a couple of words from the Progressive Radio Network.
Evolution. Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
South of the border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business or buying a house or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and click on the link to the Expat Files. Nos vemos.
I kiss the smile upon her face.
Hello, I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and you can hear my program, If You Love This Planet, right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Sunday at 3 p.m. Please join me as I interview a huge variety of special guests from around the world about a range of topics, including the health of the planet and prescriptions for survival. So, if you do love this planet, tune in to the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday at 3 p.m.
Ever wonder why some people have successful lives? Well, let's shrink about this. Hi, I'm Dr. Molly Barrow, author of Matchlines for Singles and the Malia and Teacup Self-Esteem Building Series for Children. Please join me and my guests every Tuesday morning from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to explore psychological and practical problem solving, from personal issues to world events. You can call in to join the conversation or just enjoy listening. If you're looking for balance in your relationship, career choices, family, and your planet, please join Dr. Molly Barrow and Shrink About This Tuesday at 10 Eastern on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
People come and people go, they shiver with us in the rain. And I'm not ready to put New York away. I've got favorites round the spot of blue. I've got places I love to stay. And I'm not ready to put New York away. Got the most beautiful women living in her arms, tucked in safe tonight. Got peaceful men hiding in her streets. Got laughter and so much time. So much soul in her every finger, with every note she plays. That's why.
Well, there you go. That's the DJ Green Arrow, actually, is a jungle groove. It's I'm Not Ready to Put New York Away, one of his songs. He's here with us in the studio. I was actually going to try to play it in a few minutes so we could announce it, but he preempted the whole thing. And Matt went ahead and played it, so we'll have to go out with another one of my songs a little bit later. But we're back here on News Dissector Radio on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Just before we get back into the conversation about the Middle East, I want to tell you about an event happening this week at April 6th at the NYU Bookstore, 6:30 in the evening. And I'm going to be talking about my new book, The Crime of Our Time, about the financial crisis as a crime story, and running some excerpts from my film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. So it's going to be the NYU Bookstore. It's a big bookstore. It's a great event. Our friend here, Kat, organized this event. It's near Waverly Place, right on Broadway, across from Tisch, the film school and whatnot, on right there. You can go to 8th Street. or Astor Place subway stations and find the NYU bookstore. It's also listed on my blog. Please, you're invited to come. Come meet me and hear what I have to say about the financial crisis. So April 6th, NYU bookstore, New York, New York. It's so nice we say it twice. Okay, thank you. So now back to you, Mr. Gupta. Let's talk a little bit about your coverage of the Middle East, because I think it's pretty interesting.
Well, what we've been trying to get a variety of different perspectives in terms of doing country-by-country reports. I think there's been a lot of discussion over the last few months, like, oh, is this like, 1989 or, 1848?
Post-1968?
Right, when these are different revolutionary epochs throughout the world. And I had actually, interestingly enough, had just finished a couple of months ago reading Eric Hobsbawm's book on the Age of Revolutions.
Let's tell people who he is, one of the great historians of all time.
He's a towering historian. I think he's close to 100 years old now and still writing.
I heard him speak in England, years and years ago. What a great man,
Yeah. And so he's done this series of whole books, four books that I think it's grouped under the title like The History of Civilization. And there's the first one is 1789 to 1848, which is the Age of Revolution, and then the next one is the Age of Capital, the Age of Empires, the Age of Extremes. He synthesizes just a tremendous amount of material, and it's a history, but it contains all sorts of kind of philosophical insights. And one of the things he really emphasizes is understanding the different revolutionary epochs that happened. There was a series of revolutions that went on during this 50-60 year period, and where revolutions in one country would inspire off another one, but you had to understand them according to the local conditions, what the particularities in each culture, in each country, the different cultures that played a role. So, that's what we're really trying to do is, you can't just make sweeping claims about, there's this general Arab uprising. Of course there is, but that's limiting in and of itself, because for one, there's also uprisings, democratic uprisings in other countries, say throughout Africa, and of course at one point China was afraid that there was going to be this Jasmine Revolution, and what we saw in Wisconsin in terms of these incidences of solidarity, where people were referencing what was going on in Cairo, and we even there was a much circulated photograph of someone in Cairo holding a sign in English that said "We support the workers in Wisconsin." So these ideas really are traveling all around the world.
One of the ideas that I just was reading about on ZNet is by none other than Emmanuel Wallerstein, one of the great thinkers about systems and about change.
Yeah.
And he talks about Libya as a great distraction. He's saying the entire Libyan conflict of the last month, the civil war in Libya, the U.S.-led military action against Gaddafi is neither about humanitarian intervention nor about the immediate supply of world oil. It is, in fact, one big distraction, a deliberate distraction from the principal political struggle in the Arab world. There is one thing on which Gaddafi and Western leaders of all political views are in total accord. They all want to slow down, channel, co-opt, limit the second Arab revolt and prevent it from changing the basic political realities of the Arab world and its role in the geopolitics of the world system. Big ideas, but an interesting take on it, not the kind of take that we're usually getting, that actually the whole Gaddafi thing is a way not to talk about the revolutions and what their meaning is. as in the context of the Middle East, and of course those revolutions are ongoing. And I felt your coverage of Libya was, you know, fairly balanced in terms of talking about how horrible Gaddafi was, how there was a popular uprising, but also it's kind of coalesced into this rebel force, which we really don't know very much about. Now, today, the U.S. government has announced that it's not going to be arming these rebels. That's what it says publicly. Of course, we have spooks on the ground there, the CIA in Libya, and who knows what they're really doing. I mean, we know what they're saying, but whether or not they're arming the rebels or parts of the rebels or the rebels of the rebels, we don't know yet. I mentioned on this program a while back, having watched a report on Rachel Maddow's show on MSNBC, and she's talking, you know, to the chief correspondent of NBC News, and she's saying, tell me about the rebels. Who are they? And the guy says, well, gee, I don't know myself. And he's covering them, right? He's in Benghazi, live, via satellite. And she says, what do you mean you don't know who they are? You're right there. What can you? He says, that's a little confusing. He says,
well, you know, the thing about Wallerstein's comment, I think I generally agree with him that there is a strange confluence of interest between the U.S. and the West. I think, though, it's a little overly determined, you know, that like some of his work could be, he makes it sound like, you know, it was almost planned this way. And I'm not sure that I would call it
a great distraction,
you know.
But back to this, let me just get this like little anecdote in there because maybe you can react to this. So the chief correspondent of NBC is talking to one of the rebels and he's saying, why are you opposing Gaddafi? The guy says, because Gaddafi is Jewish. Okay, that's what the rebel leader or rebel is saying. And he says,
wow.
What? You know, in other words, you know, sometimes what's really going on in people's heads is not what's really going on in our press in describing them. And can you imagine? I mean, this thing has been going on for weeks now. We still don't really know who the, quote, rebels are, who's funded them, who's supplying them, who's supporting them, and what they really want. What are they, just against Gaddafi because they don't like him? Is it a tribal dispute? Is it a civil war? Is it really a freedom struggle? I mean, I don't know, frankly. And that's why partly I'm very suspicious of the NATO-U.S. intervention. You know, our president, Patricia, you love this, you know, said, we are getting out of this. We're turning it over to NATO. Okay? Without mentioning that the U.S. basically controls NATO.
Yeah,
thought
exactly.
About comment?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was very clear from Europe from the beginning that this would not happen if NATO wasn't behind it. And knowing that, of course, the U.S. had to be on board. I mean, the funny thing is, I would say that the average European people are very happy that this is actually happening, that the U.S. is finally on board, because it's seen as, you know, cooperation when this has never happened before in this open manner, right?
Well, the U.S. is supporting the NATO. NATO is supporting, they're all supporting the war in Afghanistan. You know,
exactly.
There were just a number of people killed in Afghanistan just today, I guess, you know, in Mara al-Sharif, you know, the town, and I mispronounced that, I'm sorry, but the town where, like, the Northern Alliance, the first big uprising was, and the CIA people took all these people into this old fort and murdered them, you know.
It was the United Nations, actually,
yeah.
People. And I wanted to add to what Wallerstein was mentioning, is that if it is distracting about the rest of the revolutions, it would also be distracting from people in Europe to be well-informed about the financial crisis, I would say. I mean, Europe, of course, is very concerned about what's going on in Libya because, you know, it was a partner, an oil partner for Europe. But at the same time, this is helping the whole financial issues and what the European Union is doing about that, and also about legislation, about collective bargaining, by the way. There's this whole legislation being reviewed about how much unions in general can bargain in Europe being passed. And this is all being covered by the war and the revolutions and all these.
Yeah,
know?
Everybody's looking away, not at what's really happening in front of them. And we just, here in America, of course, Wisconsin has been the epicenter center of all of this, and the judge in Wisconsin just basically shot down, at least for now, Governor Scott Walker's big reform there, which would strip collective bargaining rights. Meanwhile, the legislature in Ohio has just passed a mega rule like that. So there's this wave of anti-union behavior in the United States as well as in other countries, are rationalizing capitalism, trying to prevent workers from having any power, at all. And this is something which is very, troubling, needless to say, to people who want to make change in America, because however compromised and however out of it a lot of unions are, there's still, a social force and have been a financial force in progressive politics. So you remove the unions, the Democratic Party goes bye-bye in many places. And not that that's going to be necessarily a great loss, but it will be a big problem if the right wing consolidates totally and controls everything. I got a call from Sherry, but I can't seem to get it because she left a voicemail in the middle of the show, so I don't know what it is. But I do know that we want to hear from you if you want to join us at 888-874-4888. This is not a big network for call-ins, unless your name is Gary Null, but I like to throw it out there anyway because I like to hear from various people in terms of a response. Kat is here, and come over here, Kat. She has an event which one of your editors is apparently part of. Can you read this?
I was given this the other day at the anti-war demonstration where Obama was at a fundraiser, and I just happened to pull it out of my bag, and I noticed the Independent is on here, and it's whose press? Our press. The Free Press Alternative Media, it's supposed to be tomorrow, April 2nd at 7:30 p.m. at Freedom Hall, 113 West 128th Street in Harlem. So I thought I'd just kind of throw it out there.
Okay, it's been thrown. Arun, talk to me now about what kind of feedback and reaction are you getting at The Independent to your work and your articles? I mean, the assumption is that if something is any longer than 140 characters, i.e. a tweet, nobody's interested. Has that been your experience?
No, not at all. I mean, what we're trying to do is to do high-quality journalism and to show that is the print media crumbles in many ways. A lot of publications going under, a lot of them just chasing after the most banal and insipid stories. We had a
big one here about Egypt in New York, Patricia. I don't know if you saw this one. An Egyptian cobra snake escaped from the Bronx Zoo, causing panic throughout the city. It's now been found. Apparently, it didn't go too far.
Oh, good. How crazy is that?
But it's been the subject of God knows how much print attention, discussion, humorous, satire, and the rest. So that gets attention.
We haven't had anything about Charlie Sheen yet. though, I think there are actually some things to say about him that haven't, kind of dissecting the role he plays in popular culture. But in any case, people do hunger and crave these ideas. And also, we try to clearly explain stuff, but we don't try to, we're against dumbing things down, and we, I don't think it's unwarranted to expect a little bit from your readers. Maybe they might have to read the article twice to fully get the ideas out of it. But it's not fluff. These are difficult ideas.
All right, speaking of not fluff, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Sherry Welch, the dissectress, is on the line from Atlanta. She couldn't stay away, and maybe has a thought to share on the whole not fluff question.
And that fluff question, I think it's winning anytime we don't focus on Charlie Sheen. That's my personal take on it.
I loved him in Apocalypse Now, though, didn't you? His family.
No, that was his father, Martin.
Oh, was it Martin?
Yeah, Charlie did Wall Street.
Oh, okay, sorry about that. Okay.
That's all right. The father's a much better actor. So how are you today, Danny?
I'm doing okay. How are you feeling?
outstanding. It's a delicious prevarication, but better than the inconvenient truth.
But we have with us, you know, a journalist from Spain, Green Arrow, from Brooklyn, New York, Kat, from, you know, Bay Ridge, which may or may not be a separate republic within Brooklyn, and myself here having a little schmooze-a-rama on News Dissector Radio. There's an event happening down in Atlanta that we mentioned in our blog today. Do you want to mention that about, you know, about the jobs issue, the details on that?
They're having a jobs issue across the United States, actually, not just in Atlanta, in honor of April 4th, the anniversary of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King on Monday. That's when the anniversary is. So the good news is that jobs went up this month, you know, for the month of March, and unemployment, you know, went down. So if people want to go and check that out, it's Speak Out for Jobs. It's called We Are One. .org, I believe, is the website. And they're having a whole thing, but Monday is the major day.
It's the Jobs with Justice is organizing it. You know, I don't know if you saw the New York Times. How would you have seen it? You're in Atlanta.
They have this thing called the Internet Daily.
On your iPad, which you don't have yet. But, you know, there is a story basically saying, yes, some jobs have been created, but a lot of the jobs in retail or in various places that have been created, you cannot make enough money to pay your bills. You can't generate enough income to pay, you know, heat, pay for food, pay for your other living expenses. So in a way, people are, with or without jobs, are being squeezed increasingly in our economy. It's a little deceptive to talk about unemployment has gone down when a lot of unemployment is not even counted anymore. If you're not looking for work, you're not considered unemployed. And youth unemployment, minority unemployment is twice the average of the national average of unemployment. So you got to be careful when you...
Yeah, the real unemployment and underemployment rate is actually closer to 20%. The Bureau of Labor Statistics tracks this rate called the U6 rate, where they add in discouraged workers and underemployed, and that's been tracking around 16%.
Wow.
But it doesn't, that still doesn't include young workers who have never been able to enter the workforce, as well as older workers who have involuntarily taken retirement.
Yep.
So, you know, we're essentially at close to Great Depression levels because, you know, the unemployment numbers there were 25%.
What about in Spain? I mean, isn't it even getting really serious worse there?
It is really bad. I mean, as you've heard in the past few days, the prime minister in Portugal resigned due to budget issues. And if Portugal goes down, Spain is going to go down afterwards. So things are not
going. This European debt crisis, not over yet. This crisis here in America is not over yet. One of the people who writes for you is a friend of ours, Max Wolf, who works in the financial services industry, but is also an analyst and critic, and he's been following and tracking this whole unemployment issue with great care, and is somebody who's a great asset if you want to know more about it. And he also writes for The Independent. So, you know, it's another part of what you're offering there are people who are really in the know who can share information. And, you know, this is something we're trying to deal with also to the degree we can. Sherry and I and all of us here have been working on trying to promote my film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, which is yet to be reviewed by The Independent, by the way. But we're going to be at the NYU bookstore on April 6th, and we're going to be... We're going to be talking about these issues about, you know, Wall Street is not too big to jail. We want to see a jail out, not a bailout. We want to see the people who are responsible for this crime, held accountable. And that's what we're trying to work on. And it's, you know, it's like a lot of people, when we talk about distraction, a lot of people don't want to even deal with it. What's been your experience, anybody in the room, about trying to talk this issue up and getting, you know, people looking at you saying, duh, what are you talking about?
Well, this is Green Arrow, and a lot of people just don't have the vocabulary within their frame of mind. They can't understand that it's a crime, and, you know, it's almost like it's in a language territory that people don't have in their brain. So when you go to try to talk to about them, they don't understand that, you know, 15 million people with foreclosure problems.
Yeah.
I mean, those are like Holocaust numbers. It's, you know, it's, I'm not saying it's worse than death, but I mean, it's terrible.
It's a living death, DJ. It's horrible for them.
And, you know, interesting, I have a little angle in my blog today. That it's just been reported that the Federal Reserve Bank helped bail out the National Bank of Libya, okay, with a big infusion of capital into Libya. And, you know, maybe Libya wasn't paying back, so this whole war is just a big foreclosure action to kind of go in and take back, you know, from Libya because they're not paying, you know, on the loan. I don't know. But, you know, we're in a situation where these financial issues, even though they seem very complex and complicated, you can wrap your head around them. You can understand them. You can make an effort. That's why I've written a book about
it.
Pardon me?
It's called theft. It's plunder.
There you go. That's a good idea for a film, that name. Anyway, if you're interested in more on that, go to our website, Plunder, the Crime of Our Time. We want to also pay our respects today. Just, I think it was yesterday, Dan Ellsberg, the Pentagon Paper leaker, great fighter for freedom and, you know, who's been very supportive of Bradley Manning and the WikiLeaks issue of getting information to people, is turning 80 years old. And on April 8th, it's his birthday. So from one Dan to another, happy birthday, Dr. Ellsberg. We admire you. We respect you. We love you. We sometimes find it hard to listen to you when you go on and on and on too much, like me. But nevertheless, we think you have done a great service to this country, and you continue to do so, even though they keep arresting you for standing up for your rights. But Dan Ellsberg, 80 years old. Everybody here in the studio, thank you for being with us. Sherry, last thought?
Let's go raise a ruckus.
Okay. You know, I'm sure that Kat agrees with that. She's doing the special Raise a Ruckus drum beat on the table, not aware of how that reverberates through our microphones. Green Arrow, thank you for being with us. Patricia, for visiting from Spain and sharing some of your experience. Arun Gupta, thank you for joining this disjointed conversation, but it was really important, and I think hopefully we've found a few new readers for the independent newspaper, which is doing such a marvelous job as independent journalists, and we hope to work with you more closely in the future. So there you go, Pope people, another edition of News Dissector Radio. Check out our blog at newsdissector.com/blog. PlunderTheCrimeOfOurTime.com is another important website. You can listen to the podcast, which will be posted on my blog and on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com site, and share it with your friends. And we'll be back again next week to do it all again. Thank you. Thank you, Matt, for engineering this mayhem. And we'll see you soon.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold when Wall Street stepped into the fold. Congress paid off, workers paid off. Stanford, AIG, and Madoff. Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets.